White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to Episode 7 of the International Jew Study Hour. Today is August 16th, 2012. We're going to be studying Chapter 6 of Henry Ford's great work, and it is a very interesting chapter indeed, in my opinion. I'm Carolyn Yeager, here with my co-host, Hadding Scott. Hello. Hadding. Yeah, well, you beat me to it. Well, I think Chapter 6 is kind of short, but it's really interesting, and there's a lot of things that are in it that we can talk about, so we won't have any problem, I think. I don't think we'll want to go on to the next chapter today, so I like to just stick with one chapter at a time. And okay. This chapter is called Jewish Question Breaks Into the Magazines. Do you want to give any preliminaries before you start reading it?
Well, we can just, I don't have any preliminary ready, so we can just get into it.
Right, because we'll have some things to say in between. I have something right after the little quote. All right.
Okay. It starts off with a quote from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the seventh protocol, it says. We must force the Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan already approaching its triumphal goal by bringing to bear the pressure of stimulated public opinion, which has in reality been organized by us with the help of the so-called great power of the press. With few exceptions not worth considering, it has already fallen into our hands.
Wow, well, that was good. That's from the seventh protocol.
That sounded very convincing, didn't it?
Yes.
Of course, protocols, of course, are not an authentic document.
You say so, although I'm not convinced either way.
It's more than my say-so. Well, you don't need much. You can look at Wikipedia. It tells you basically all you need to know. The fact that it wasn't... The evidence that it wasn't authentic was only published the next year, so Ford had no way of knowing it. Now, this does sound like the truth. We don't need the protocols to tell us this, do we? That Jews control mass media and they use it for their own purposes. We can tell that by observation.
Well, what's interesting is that, like they do with the Holocaust, they say it was planned in advance and it was carefully planned by the Nazis. The protocols show that, whether true or not, but that what they're showing is that that this was all planned by the Jews for our destruction, right? So, but you're right. We can see it's something either is happening or it isn't.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, later on in this chapter, Henry Ford actually, or whoever wrote it, actually says pretty much that the protocols told us what we already knew.
Yeah, okay.
People always think you're telling the truth if you tell them what they already believe. You know.
Well, here's a little thing I saw a few days ago about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. So I'm going to mention it here. It's an article. It was in a Jewish newspaper or something. Jewish website, European rabbis ask Apple, you know, Apple the computer company, to remove anti-Semitic ebook, you know which one. It says a group of European rabbis is requesting that Apple remove an app, you know, an app, APP, appliance, I guess those are, from the App Store that they consider to be anti-Semitic. The Conference of European Rabbis wants Apple to remove the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Although, here's a quote by Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt, although the protocol, and that's be that guy that just read the little quote that we heard. Although the protocols of the Elders of Zion can and should be available for academics to study in its proper context, to disseminate such hateful invective as a mobile app is dangerous and inexcusable. And it goes on to tell us that the protocols were first published in the early 1900s. They describe a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world. It's widely thought to be nothing but propaganda and is embraced primarily by extremists. Mm-hmm. Let's see if there's anything. But this app in question is in Arabic. And it's a translated version of the app's... a translated version from Arabic of the app's description includes a history of the book and mentions that many historians believe it to be a hoax and a conspiracy theory. So, right. You know, it's not like it's trying. They're trying to promote it. The app was released in March and is selling for under £1. It said it was only discovered because it is in. It was not discovered earlier because it's in Arabic, and it's not available in the U.S. version of iTunes. It's more a rebuttal of the protocols than the actual book, and so on. But Goldschmidt continues to insist that it be removed. So that it's because it's going to be used by anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists and their fellow travelers. And then they add at the bottom here, Adolf Hitler and the Nazi regime relied heavily on the protocols of the Elders of Zion and some other stuff. You know, that's not true.
It's not true.
It's not true at all. And they say that the centerpiece of Hitler's Mein Kampf, you know, was this. Well, that's a total lie.
I think he mentions it once. He mentions it once, kind of as an aside. He says the best proof of the authenticity of the protocols is that it fits what they're doing, and that's what everybody says, and that's a true statement. That is the best proof. It's not an adequate proof, and it doesn't overcome the evidence that they're not authentic.
Okay. Well, anyway, we see how they're pushing. They push their stuff, and they lie about it, and then they sit and scream around if you say anything, if you have anything that questions what they're doing, and they scream around how it's a big lie. Well, that's all I wanted to say about that.
All right. Okay. The Jewish question breaks into the magazines.
Yep.
Once upon a time, an American faculty member of an American university... I guess he says that so that you know it's not a Jew or not a Russian, maybe. Mm-hmm. An American faculty member of an American university went to Russia on business. He was expert in a very important department of applied science and a keen observer. He entered Russia with the average American's feeling about the treatment which the government of that people accorded the Jew. He lived there 3 years, came home for a year, and went back again for a similar period. And upon his second return to America, he thought it was time to give the American public accurate information about the Jewish question in Russia. He prepared a most careful article and sent it to the editor of a magazine of the first class in the eastern United States. The editor sent for him, spent most of 2 days with him, and was deeply impressed with all he learned. But said he could not print the article. The same interest and examination occurred with several other magazine editors of the first rank. It was not because the professor could not write. These editors gladly bought anything he would write on other subjects. But it was impossible for him to get his article on the Jews accepted or printed in New York. The Jewish question, however, has at last broken into a New York magazine. Rather, it is a fragment of a shell hurled from the Jewish camp at the Jewish question to demolish, if possible, the question, and thus make good the assertion that there is no such thing. Incidentally, it is the only kind of article on the Jewish question that the big magazines, whose mazes of financial controllers make most interesting rummaging, would care to print. Yet the general public may learn much about the question, even from the type of article whose purpose is to prove that the question doesn't exist. Mr. William Hard, in the Metropolitan for June, has done as well as could be expected, considering the use he was supposed to make of such material as he had at hand. That's June 1920. And doubtless the telegraph and letter brigades, which keep watch over all printed references to the Jews, have duly congratulated the good editors of the Metropolitan for their assistance in soothing the public to further sleep.
Now, I was wondering, even if William Hard doesn't sound at all Jewish, whether he might have been Jewish, but I looked him up, and anyway, he's not a Jew, so people, that comes up a little bit later, but if people are wondering about that, and he was the editor, I don't know if he was just a writer, I never could get that clear, or the editor of the Metropolitan, but it was a popular magazine of the time. He was just a writer.
Yeah, I looked him up, too. The name of the article is The Great Jewish Conspiracy.
Yeah.
And that's available on Google Books. And it's
I had it, but then I didn't have... I had it today, but I couldn't... I didn't read it. I'm going to go back and read it, though.
It's a skeptical view of Jewish conspiracy claims.
Yeah.
He was... William Hard was a son of missionaries, and he spent part of his childhood in India. And he was involved in Republican Party politics. And he was also a news correspondent in early radio, Washington, D.C. correspondent in early radio from 1929 till about 1935.
Oh, after this, because this is 1920. Well, it sounded like the way that they're writing about him, that he's a regular with the Metropolitan. He's a regular writer. Or he's a regular writer, maybe for various publications. I don't know, but he's pretty well known.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. They say here the telegraph and letter brigades, which keep watch over all printed references to the Jews, letters and telegrams from the Jews, complaining if they see anything that they know. It's not just the ADL doing it. They've got all these Jews out there doing it too.
Yeah.
Already then.
All right. It is to be hoped, for the sake of the question, that Mr. Hard's effort will have a wide reading, for there is very much to be learned from it, much more than it was anybody's intention should be learned from it. It may be learned, first, that the Jewish question exists. Mr. Hard says it is discussed in the drawing rooms of London and Paris. Whether the mention of drawing rooms was a writer's device to intimate that the matter was unimportant and frivolous, or merely represented the extent of Mr. Hard's contact with the question, is not clear. He adds, however, that a document relating to the question has traveled a good bit in certain official circles in Washington. He also mentions a cable dispatched to the New York World concerning the same question, which that paper published.
Well, isn't this document he's talking about, isn't it the protocols?
Probably.
That's what it sounds like to me. They don't say it, but they do start with that quote. And this is what was causing a lot of talk, a lot of discussion, you know, amongst people who would be aware of such things. And this was the only thing that he's found that was written about it, you know.
Well, Cordy, I read a bit of William Hard's essay, and he says that there were three documents that had recently been produced.
Oh, he did say what they were? He doesn't even say what they are?
Not the part that I read.
Okay.
All right. His article was probably published too early to note the review which the London Times made of the first document referred to. But he has told the reader who is looking for the objective facts in the article that there is a Jewish question and that it does not exist among the riffraff either, but principally in those circles where the evidence of Jewish power and control is most abundant. Moreover, the question is being discussed. Mr. Hard tells us that much. If he does not go further, and tell us that it is being discussed with great seriousness in high places and among men of national and international importance, it is probably because of one of two things. Either he does not know, or he does not consider it consonant with the purpose of the article to tell. However, Mr. Hard has already made it clear that there is a Jewish question, that it is being discussed, and that it is being discussed by people who are best situated to observe the matter they are talking about. The reading of Mr. Hard's article makes it clear also that the question always comes to the fore on the note of conspiracy. Of course, Mr. Hard says he does not believe in conspiracies, which involve a large number of people. And it is with the utmost ease that his avowal of unbelief is accepted. This is important here. For there is nothing more ridiculous to the Gentile mind than a mass conspiracy, because there is nothing more impossible to the Gentile himself.
Yeah, I had that bold too. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. Mr. Hard, we take it, is of non-Jewish extraction, and he knows how impossible it would be to band Gentiles together in any considerable number for any length of time in even the noblest conspiracy. Gentiles are not built for it. Their conspiracy, whatever it might be, would fall like a rope of sand. Gentiles have not the basis either in blood or interest that the Jews have to stand together. The Gentile does not naturally suspect conspiracy. He will indeed hardly bring himself to the verge of believing it without the fullest proof.
Yeah, now, you know, we've had a lot of proof build up, which allows us today, some of us, to understand it and you know, accept it and believe in it. But most people still won't. And I think this, and there's others more after this. I think this, though, is where we where I see that that these two groups of people cannot find any way to live together without it being to the detriment of the Gentiles. But I'll have more to say about that.
It is therefore quite easy to understand Mr. Hard's difficulty with conspiracy. The point is that to write his article at all, he is forced to recognize at almost every step that whenever the Jewish question is discussed, the idea of conspiracy occupies a large part in it. As a matter of fact, it is the central idea in Mr. Hard's article, and it completely monopolizes the heading, Great Jewish Conspiracy. The search for basic facts in Mr. Hard's article will disclose the additional information that there are certain documents in existence which purport to contain the details of the conspiracy, or, to drop a word that is unpleasant and maybe misleading and which has not been used in this series, the tendency of Jewish power to achieve complete control.
Well, it's got to be the protocols.
Yeah, I think so. That is about all that the reader learns from Mr. Hard about the documents, except that he describes one as strange and horrible.
Yeah.
Strange.
You know, everybody who reads that, except for the Jews who just insist that it's not made up. But everybody who reads any of that starts to just can't, it's just sickening. It just, there's something about it. And you wonder, I find it a little bit strange that if it has such an effect of a negative effect on people that it wouldn't necessarily be something that people who didn't know about that and don't think that way would make up. So that's one reason, because I know I have the book and I was going to read it all, and I was real interested in the beginning. I was reading away, and then at some point, I just couldn't read anymore. And I thought, well, I'll take a break. Well, I never got back to it. It really is. It gives you a horrible feeling.
Well, it does represent things that the Gentiles would never do, but it doesn't really accurately represent the way Jews operate either. Dr. William Pierce pointed out in there's one of his programs that he did called The New Protocols. He points out that when Jews get together to plan things, they don't talk the way the protocols talk. They don't get together and say, "And this is what we
can do." How does he know? How does he know how they talk? How do any of us know how they talk?
He had subscriptions to Jewish publications, so he could get inside dope. You know, they don't talk about doing harm to
the world.
Everything is couched in benevolent humanitarian language.
Yeah, but this was not meant for us to read. This was the secret. You know, the protocols was not meant to become public, from what I understand.
Of course it was. It's fiction. It was written to warn people about Jews, but it's not authentic.
Okay.
This is certain. All right.
All right.
Here is indeed a regrettable gap in the story, for it is to discredit a certain document that Mr. Hard writes, and yet he tells next to nothing about it. Discreditable documents usually discredit themselves, but this document is not permitted to do that. The reader of the article is left to take Mr. Hard's word for it. The serious student or critic will feel, of course, that the documents themselves would have formed a better basis for an intelligent judgment. But laying that matter aside, Mr. Hard has made public the fact that there are documents. And then Mr. Hard does another thing, as well as he can with the materials at hand, the purpose of the article being what it is, and that is to show how little the Jews have had to do with the control of affairs by showing who are the Jews that do control certain selected groups of affairs.
Repeat that sentence. That's a complicated sentence.
And then Mr. Hard does another thing, as well as he can with the materials at hand, the purpose of the article being what it was, and that is to show how little the Jews have to do with the control of affairs, by showing who are the Jews that do control certain selected groups of affairs. In other words, he's saying, well, Jews don't control very much. Look, here's the list of Jews that actually have positions of control.
Right.
The names are all brought forward by Mr. Hard, and he alone is responsible for them. Our purpose in referring to them being merely to show what can be learned from him. Mr. Hard leans heavily on Russian affairs. Sometimes it would almost seem as if the Jewish question were conceived as the Soviet question, which it is not, as Mr. Hard very well knows. And although the two have their plain connections, it is nothing less than well-defined propaganda to set up Bolshevist fiction and knock it down by Jewish fact for the purpose of the latter. However, what Mr. Hard offers as fact is very instructive, quite apart from the conclusion which he draws from it. Now, take his Russian lineup first. He says that in the cabinet of Soviet Russia, there is only one Jew, but he is Trotsky. There are others in the government, of course, but Mr. Hard is speaking about the cabinet now. He is not speaking about the commissars, who are the real rulers of Russia, nor about the executive troops, who are the real strength of the Trotsky-Lenin regime. No, just the cabinet. Of course, there was only one Jew prominent in Hungary, too, but he was Béla Kun. Mr. Hard does not ask us to believe, however, that it is simply because of Trotsky and Kun that all Europe believes that Bolshevism has a strong Jewish element. Else the stupid credibility of the Gentiles would be more impossible of conception than the idea of a Jewish conspiracy is to Mr. Hard's mind. Why should it be easier to believe that Gentiles are dunces than that Jews are clever?
I like that very much. And this comes to this this idea that because we Gentiles are allowing this to happen to us, because what he's calling it stupid credibility. Well, I go along with the stupid credibility of the Gentiles, but that doesn't. But what I would say is that we don't have the defenses against these people, and that's why, as I was said, I was going to mention above. That's why we have to make sure that we are not victims of theirs by being in the same, the same communities, the same nations as there, by not allowing them to be in our world. Now, look, if they say, people say, well, we have to learn how to deal with this kind of thing. No, we can't learn how. It's not in our DNA. It's not in us. We're not made that way. The thing we have to do is get rid of it. That's what we have to. We have that in the name of self-defense. I'm not saying this very well, but in the name of self-defense, we say, okay, you people have something that is just so hostile to us, and we really are not capable of understanding it on a wide basis. But the other thing we need then, in order to do this, we need leadership that understands this, and it should be taught in our academies and so on, what the Jew does. And this leadership is going to do what's necessary to defend us. And this is exactly what the National Socialists did. That's what National Socialism was all about. It was set up to defend the German nation, the German people, in a sense. Yeah. I think this is very good, in a way of explaining why this is necessary and why we can't be expected to somehow be a match to this kind of personality. We're not stupid, but we don't have what it takes to defend ourselves against them.
We're trusting, not the same to be trusting and to be stupid.
Yeah.
You know, just because you don't have suspicions doesn't mean you're incapable of understanding what's going on once you know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good.
There's a marching band going by a few blocks away.
Well, it must be high school, huh?
No.
Oh.
However, it is not too much to say that Trotsky is way up at the top, sharing the utmost summit of Bolshevism with Lenin. And Trotsky is a Jew. Nobody ever denied that, not even Mr. Braunstein himself. It's Braunstein, I think. The latter being Trotsky's St. Louis, USA name. Well, of course, Lenin also was partly of Jewish extraction.
This yes, they probably didn't know that then, huh?
That was suppressed for decades. Mm-hmm. But then, says Mr. Hard, the Mensheviks are led by Jews, too. That is a fact worth putting down beside the others. Trotsky is at the head of the Bolsheviks, at the head of the Mensheviks, during their opposition of the Bolsheviks, were Lieber, Martov, and Dan, all Jews, says Mr. Hard. There is, however, a middle party between these extremes, the cadets, which Mr. Hard says are, or were, the strongest bourgeois political party in Russia. They now have their headquarters in Paris, says Hard. Their chairman is Vinaver, a Jew. There are the facts as stated. There are the facts stated as stated. There. Let's try it over. There are the facts as stated by Mr. Hard. He says that Jews whose names he gives head the three greatest divisions of political opinion in Russia. And then he cries, look how the Jews are divided. How can there be conspiracy among people who thus fight themselves? But another, looking at the same situation, may say, look how the Jews control every phase of political opinion in Russia. Doesn't there seem to be some ground for the feeling that they are desirous of ruling everywhere? The facts are there. What significance does it bring to the average mind that the three great parties of Russia are led by Jews? Now, I could also point out that he talks about William Hard there, talks about the Mensheviks being led by Jews during their period of opposition to the Bolsheviks, a couple of facts that Hard left out, to which Ford or his writer, Mr. Cameron, or whoever it is, alludes, which is the fact that eventually the Bolsheviks tried to get the Mensheviks to come back, and originally they were two factions of the same party. I have some notes about that. There was a conference at Zimmerwald in Switzerland in 1915 where the split occurred. And I have the note that the socialist leaders at Zimmerwald in September 1915 were Martov, Jew, Trotsky, Jew, Lenin, part Jew, Zinoviev, Jew, Radek, Jew, Pavel Axelrod, Jew, Maximilian Horvitz, Jew, Adolf Varsky, Jew, and Angelika Balabanov, I think she's a Jew. So, I mean, it's the socialist leaders at this conference, the last conference where before the Bolshevik and Menshevik split, the leaders were all Jews.
Well, and so they were Jews on both sides.
Yeah.
What you're saying, right?
Well, they come from a party. Mensheviks and Bolsheviks were the same party originally. And they split, and both factions were led by Jews. The rank and file of the Bolsheviks, on average, were less Jewish than the rank and file of the Mensheviks.
Mm-hmm.
The Bolsheviks had an easier time making popular appeal, apparently.
Yeah, see, mostly I have never really studied this period here, and just, you know, here and there I read all kinds of things about it, but I was always, would have been under the impression, if I was asked, that the Mensheviks were not so Jewish, but the Bolsheviks were the Jews. That's what I would have thought. So I was surprised when I think you're the first person that told me that.
Yeah, see, the difference between the Mensheviks, this is one difference anyway. The Mensheviks were more like Orthodox Marxists. They wanted to have the slow progress through the bourgeois decadence, and then eventually the development into communism. The Bolsheviks just wanted to cut to the chase. And since there were a lot of social problems going on, people didn't have enough food and so on, this Bolshevik idea of cutting to the chase and just having a big redistribution of food and so forth and wealth and whatever, that had a lot of appeal. So I think that's what helped them to beat out the Mensheviks.
Hmm.
Because you needed people that were willing to exert some effort and be forceful. You needed revolutionaries, people, boots on the ground, so to speak. I don't know if you could really do that with a bunch of Jews. they needed to get some goyim into it.
Uh-huh.
And the Bolsheviks apparently were better able to do that.
Okay.
All right.
They're better able to get the non-Jews to cooperate with them, yeah, because they were the less Jewish group. Yeah, I see.
Well, their whole political attitude was better suited to the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when you see, there was a very bad situation after the Tsar was overthrown and the provisional government was established, which was sort of socialist, and problems were not being solved. So there was an opportunity for the Bolsheviks to take over because the situation was not good.
Mm-hmm.
They could exploit that. Okay. The facts are there. What significance does it bring to the average mind that the three great parties of Russia are led by Jews? But that does not exhaust the information which the matter-of-fact reader may find in Mr. Hard's article. He turns to the United States and makes several interesting statements. There is Otto Kahn, he says. Well, sometimes Otto Kahn is there, and sometimes he is in Paris on important international matters, and sometimes he is in London advocating certain alliances between British and American capital, which have to do in a large way with European political conditions. Mr. Khan is rated as a conservative, and that may mean anything. A man is conservative or not according to the angle from which he is viewed. The most conservative men in America are really the most radical. Their motives and methods go to the very roots of certain matters. They are radicals in their own field. The men who controlled the last Republican convention, if not the last, the most recent, are styled conservatives by those whose vision is circumscribed by certain limited economic interests. But they are the most radical of the radicals. They have passed the red stage and are white with it. If it were known what is in the back of Mr. Khan's mind, if he should display a chart of what he is doing and aiming to do, the term which would then most aptly describe him might be quite different. Anyway, we have it from Mr. Hard. There is Mr. Khan.
Well, what is he meaning by saying there's Mr. Khan? Mr. Khan is an example that the Jews don't rule everything. Mr. Khan, Otto Khan was born in Mannheim, Germany, in a Jewish family. His father insisted that he become a banker, and he worked in a bank there in Germany, and then he went to London. They sent him to London to work in the banks. And finally, he went to New York for this great opportunity, and then he became a U.S. citizen. He had become a British citizen in London. He liked it so much. He was, you know, filthy rich by then. Then he went to New York, but he's one of the very important bankers of that period in the United States.
I'd say from the context that he's putting forth Mr. Otto Khan there as an example of a conservative.
A conservative.
Supposedly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, he would have appeared to be that way.
Mm. To some people, you know, we have that problem today. People that they get this label conservative, and what do they really have to offer?
Well,
on the other hand, says Mr. Hard, there is Rose Pastor Stokes. He adds the name of Morris Hillquit.
Okay, let's go to Rose Pastor Stokes. She married. She was doing a lot of work on her own. Seemed to be a hardworking. She's Jewish. She came from across the ocean too. Originally, she married a millionaire, G. Phelps Stokes, who I think was a crypto Jew. They don't call him a Jew, but he looks kind of Jewish, and he kind of behaves Jewish. But anyway, his family is old, and they came from England. So, you know, he could have Jewish blood in him, but that's not what's so important. He was very liberal, and they married. She was a very poor person who was a socialist and worked with the poor. And he was very interested in the poor and in humanitarian ideas, and seemed to be very interested in the Jewish, in the poor Jews in New York, because that's a large part of what they were there and in these settlements. And so they met and they got together. They got married. And they joined the Socialist Party of America together. Later, they were divorced. Anyway, she was always very, very active.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. They are. So you didn't have anything about Hillquit?
Yeah, Hillquit. He was born Moishe Hillkowitz. I hear something. What are you doing?
It's born, a train going by.
Oh, I thought it was your
marching bands and trains.
Okay, yeah, you got a lot going on there. Morris Hillquit was born Moishe Hillkowitz in Riga, Latvia, in 1869.
Moishe.
Yeah, and you know, his family came here too. They all came here after 1900. He was the founder and leader of the Socialist Party of America, and he was very effective. Hardworking, you know. That's all I have on him.
They are, in Mr. Hard's classification, radicals. And to offset these names, he adds the names of two Gentiles, Eugene V. Debs and Bill Haywood, and intimates that they are much more powerful leaders than the first two. Students of modern influences, of which Mr. Hard has long appeared as one, do not think so. Neither Debs nor Haywood ever generated in all their lives a fraction of the intellectual power which Mr. Stokes and Mr. Hillquit have generated. Both Debs and Haywood live by the others. To every informed person, as to Mr. Hard in this article, come the Jewish names to mind when the social tendencies of the United States are passed under reflection.
Well, of course, Debs was a big socialist leader, and Haywood, you know, I didn't actually look him up. I've heard, I know he's a liberal, some kind of a socialist. He's some kind of a real leftist from back then. I don't even, do you know his first name?
No.
But these guys, they're saying that these two guys who are more well known were not as powerful as, and didn't accomplish as much as Rose Stokes and Morris Hillquit, Moishe. So.
Well, what he seems to be saying is that these guys are like useful idiots for the Jews.
Well, in, on the Wikipedia page for Rose Stokes, there was a picture of her with Eugene Debs and, another Jewish, socialist leader. They were looking at over a piece of paper or something, you know. And so, you know, they all worked together. So I guess they were useful idiots.
This is most instructive indeed, that in naming the leaders of so-called conservatism and radicalism, Mr. Hard is driven to use Jewish names. On his showing, the reader is entitled to say that Jews lead both divisions here in the United States. But Mr. Hard is not through. The man who does more than any other man, the man who does more than any regiment of other men, to keep American labor anti-radical is a Jew, Samuel Gompers.
Well, Samuel Gompers was born in 1850 in London to a Jewish family from Amsterdam, and he founded the American Federation of Labor, the AFL.
Yeah. That is a fact which the reader will place in his list. American labor is led by a Jew.
Yep.
Well then, the strongest anti-Gompers trade union in the country, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, and very strong indeed and very large, is led by a Jew, Sidney Hillman.
Yeah, Sidney Hillman was was born in 1887 in Lithuania of Jewish parents, and he headed the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. It is big. That was very big.
It is the Russian situation all over again. Both ends of the movements and the movement which operate within the movement are under the leadership of Jews. This, whatever the construction one puts on it, is a fact which Mr. Hard is compelled by the very nature of his task to acknowledge. And the middle movement, the liberal middle, as Mr. Hard calls it, which catches all between, produces in this article the names of Mr. Justice Brandeis, Judge Mack, and Felix Frankfurter, gentlemen whose activities since Armistice Day would make a very interesting story.
Well, I didn't know who Judge Mack was, so I looked him up, and he is a Jew and Zionist on the National... He was big on the National War Labor Board during World War I, but also a whole list of stuff. And he's a big Zionist and on all kinds of committees and so on.
Mm-hmm. For good measure, Mr. Hard produces two other names. Baron Gunzburg, a Jew, who is a faithful official of the Russian embassy of Ambassador Bakhmetev, a representative of the modified old regime, while the Russian Information Bureau, whose literary output appears in many of our newspapers, is conducted by another Jew, so Mr. Hard calls him, whose name is familiar to newspaper readers, Mr. A.J. Sack. It is not a complete list by any means, but it is quite impressive. It seems to reflect importance on the documents which Mr. Hard endeavors to minimize to a position of ridiculous unimportance. And it leads to the thought that perhaps the documents are scrutinized as carefully as they are because the readers of them, have observed not only the facts which Mr. Hart admits, but other and more astonishing ones, and have discovered that the documents confirm and explain the observations. Other readers who have not had the privilege of learning all that the documents contain are entitled to have satisfaction given to the interest thus aroused. Now, I underline this where he says, and have discovered that the documents confirm and explain the observations. In other words, we don't need the protocols to tell us these things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what are these documents? Why don't we know what they are?
Well,
what do you think some of them are? Do you have some idea or not?
It's basically a kind of historical fiction, and you know, that somebody put together as.
No, I don't mean the protocols. I mean these documents he's talking about.
Oh, I don't know what the other documents would be. There's one.
And there might be some things that come out later in this book about. I don't know. We'll see.
There's one that's some document that was allegedly found on a dead communist Jew in Russia. I think that was like a few pages or something. Some very short document that's called some other protocol.
Well, and very similar, huh, to the other one.
Yeah.
Would you put stock in that and not the...
No, I think that has even less credibility.
Well, we don't know what these documents are, but...
The problem is the Russians... I think the Russians were not very scrupulous about how they handled these things.
Yeah, well, that's very likely. You mean they were just... okay.
Yeah.
It'll come up again.
Okay. The documents did not create the Jewish question. There you go. If there were nothing but the documents, Mr. Hard would not have written, nor would the Metropolitan Magazine have printed, the article here discussed. What Mr. Hard has done is to bring confirmation in a most unexpected place that the question exists and is pressing for discussion. Someone felt the pressure when the great Jewish conspiracy was ordered and written.
Well, yes, okay. So he's saying here that that this Metropolitan Magazine is the most unexpected place for this article, which it is. You know, I mean, I looked all that up, and I tried to find the cover for June 1920, this particular issue, but they didn't have that. But we do have the article, though, strangely. But I couldn't. So I used a different cover for our program page. But you know, it's by then it's kind of like a lighthearted stuff, although it has some serious articles in them. And so they say it's somebody felt pressure and ordered that this thing be written because people were talking about it and they wanted
all
to.
Right.
This is how they answer it. They
wouldn't
they
admit
bring
all
it up
that
themselves
stuff.
And then they take control of how it's presented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was listening to Michael Savage last night. Yeah, forgive me, please. He was saying a lot of stuff that he's sort of saying everything short of talking about Jews controlling things. He's talking about the Southern Poverty Law Center.
He doesn't like them, huh? Criticizes them?
Well, I mean, at least he knows that his listeners don't like them. You know, mm-hmm. This stuff is, this. You know, 10 years ago, you never would have heard that. You know, but the SPLC apparently has come under enough criticism that has spread out enough that... somebody like Michael Savage feels that it doesn't really hurt things to talk about it, and it's a way of getting some part of his audience on his side so that he can sell them Zionism, which seems to be what he's really all about. And also so that if somebody comes along and tries to say, well, you know, who's really behind all this stuff? It's really the Jews. Then they will say, but Michael Savage, what about Michael Savage? He's a Jew. Michael Savage told me about the Southern Poverty Law Center. How can that be a Jewish conspiracy when Michael Savage told me about it?
Exactly. Exactly. That's a very good example of what he's saying, what they're saying here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important to remember. Well, I finally found where I can refresh my inbox for this crummy email account that I have to use now, or CarolynJaeger.com, but it doesn't appear that anybody has sent any messages. If you do want to send something real quick, you can do it, listeners. Now, I found something good I want to quote from a German philosopher. How do you pronounce that, Hadding? Fichte?
Fichte?
Fichte, okay. Fichte.
Fichte,
Of the 18th century. He wrote about the Jewish question in the 18th century. I mean, he was in the 18th century. Boy, that's a long time ago. And they are right. What he wrote is really amazing, at least the quotes that I have. And here's one. He says, they, meaning the Jews, must have human rights, even if these do not belong to them as to us. But to give them civil rights, I see no means of doing so, at least other than cutting off one night all their heads and placing on them others in which there is not a single Jewish idea. In order to protect ourselves from them, I see no other means than to conquer their extolled land and to send them all there. Isn't that good? I mean, they talk about German anti-Semitism. They could point to this, that it's just in Germans, they can't help it. You know, they're always going to be anti-Semitic. Well, and maybe so. Germans understand that the ones who haven't been brainwashed out of it, they understood what the problem with the Jew was, and that the Jew was nothing like them, and that the Jew was going to, take over and try to change them. And so they didn't want that. They wanted to be themselves.
Well, Fichte, of course, was, from the early 19th century, they had just seen how Napoleon sort of gave the Jews a status very suddenly that they'd never had in Germany. So they associated a rise of Jewish status and rights for Jews with being conquered. That was their experience under Napoleon.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah. Well, not bad, you know. Good. But they say, I like that he says, in order to protect ourselves from them. And he says, the only thing to do is to conquer their extolled land. Extolled means the land that they talk so lovingly about, and they praise so much their Jerusalem land, you know. Right. Their Palestine. Yeah, conquer that and send them there. Well, if they had done that back then, it might have worked better, you know. It became too populated.
But they would have had to conquer all of Europe to send them all there.
Well, no, you just conquer that part and then take them all. But yeah, it's really hard. Now here's, I got this book, I'm trying to get it read. I haven't made hardly any progress in it at all. But The Track of the Jew Through the Ages by Alfred Rosenberg, which has been translated by Alexander Jacob. And he wrote a very good introduction to it. And in that, he says, Marx preached materialistic atheism to get rid of all religions and internationalism to get rid of all nations so that the world could be more easily ruled by the Jews. What do you think of that?
Marx preached
materialistic atheism to get rid of all religion and internationalism to get rid of all nations. See, I think that's pretty good, but I don't know about if you think so.
According to Marx's theory, that capitalism actually was destroying nations, and it does.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, this is what Alexander Jacob said. Well, he's a National Socialist. So now, here's something from Alfred Rosenberg. I don't know if this is a quote, but it's what he wrote about. Hatred of Christianity is Jewish. The essential characteristic of the Jew is will to power, which is totally different from Christianity. And I can see then from this that a lot of whites who say we need to take power, we need to regain our will to power, and we need to get rid of that stupid Christianity, which is, you know, just turning the other cheek and so on. But I still do not believe at all that Christianity is Jewish. I think I agree with Rosenberg that hatred of Christianity is Jewish. Rosenberg defended Christianity, although he liked the whole German traditions. But he didn't want Christianity as he didn't want the Roman Christianity. He wanted to change it into a German Christianity for Germans, which I like. All right, I like it.
Well, you know, hatred of Christianity is certainly incorporated in the Talmud. You know, Jews are supposed to spit three times when they hear the name Jesus or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And but we've read in the International Jew that there are people who blame the Jews already 100 years ago. There were people then who blamed the Jews for Christianity. So these people are also anti-Christian. You know, Voltaire was very anti-Christian. He had contempt for Christianity because he considered it to be irrational and oppressive, and he blamed the Jews for it.
Well, I don't think that's right, though. I don't think the Jews were in any way behind Christianity. I think they've infiltrated Christianity, like that's how they operate with everything. And they still, they've infiltrated it to destroy it, and they hate it. They would like to destroy it. They don't. There's all these people who say, oh, Christianity is the best tool of the Jews. They love it. No, they don't. They don't love it. They see it as a big threat to themselves. Because it is. If people were really, you know, except it's been undermined so badly.
If you stick to the Gospels, there's a lot in there that is not really Jewish. A lot of it is Greek thought of the time. I think the Paul's material is more Jewish. And to a large extent, Christianity is what people want to make of it.
That you can do that with everything. That's right. That's why there's just every kind of Christianity. You know, it's hard to talk about it because, you know, you go from A to Z, you know, and it's one end doesn't even resemble the other.
Yeah. Jews have gotten their hands into Christianity, and they've gotten influence over it. And this evangelical Christianity in the United States is very heavily under Jewish influence, and it seems to be practically designed for the support of Zionism.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening tonight. We're about done here. And next week, do you have the title of next week's chapter, Patty?
No, I don't.
I don't either. But it's an interesting one. It's another kind of short one, but it's about current writings of the year 1920. So yeah, we'll see you then. Arthur Brisbane. That's right.
Each physical help.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.